The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Richard Lee, and welcome to the last of our podcasts from the Edinburgh International Book Festival. As the festival enters the final weekend, you can detect a subtle shift of gear. After all that discussion of fiction at the Writers' Conference, we turn now to the great questions of the day, with debates rethinking Islam, Iran, even the Labour Party. Today's programme finds the Argentinian writer Carlos Gomera returning to his first novel, just published in English, and a political issue which refuses to go away, the Malvinas, or, as we say in the UK, the Falkland Islands. But first, we meet the barrister Sadaqat Kadri, whose investigation of Sharia law, Heaven on Earth, reveals the multifaceted nature of Islamic jurisprudence. And The Guardian's own Jonathan Steele, whose Ghosts of Afghanistan charts the tragic similarities between the Soviet invasion of 1979 and the US-led invasion of 2001. I began by asking Jonathan which of the myths surrounding these ill-fated expeditions is the most pernicious.
The most pernicious one, I think, is the one that says we walked away, meaning the West gave up on Afghanistan after 1989 when the Russians left, because the West had been instrumental in, you know, helping the Mujahideen to fight the Russians. And then this myth is that in 1989, when the Russians left, we walked away and left the country, abandoned it. If only they had walked away. What actually happened was they continued to arm the Mujahideen, finance them, train them, support them, and above all, tell them not to negotiate with the Kabul government, which was now an independent government without Soviet troops, and which was seeking a negotiated settlement. And the West said no, and so they provoked and prolonged the civil war, which then led to the emergence of the Taliban itself in 1996, and the civil war basically still continues.
Because you say in your book how Gorbachev wanted to pull out, and his generals were saying, you must pull out, we're not going to win this. And he was keen to get a settlement that meant that no further interference would happen. But why was this not acceptable to the West at the time?
Because the Reagan administration, they were the people in charge in Washington at the time, thought they could win a victory, and they wanted revenge against the Russians for their own defeat in Vietnam, you know, 10 years earlier. And so they really pushed it. And I try and make the contrast in the book between Obama and Gorbachev. Gorbachev came in, he inherited a war, his predecessor had started, just like Obama inherited it from Bush. But Gorbachev had the sense to see that the war was unwinnable, it was a stalemate, Russians couldn't be defeated, but they could never defeat the other side, so much better to go for a negotiated settlement.
Why is it then that Obama, who came in with a similar war that he'd inherited, allowed himself to be convinced? Why is it that he thought he could win this war?
Well, I think partly he opposed the Iraq war, which he said was a war of choice. He probably felt he couldn't oppose two wars. He felt this was a war of necessity. But don't forget
that he had to pick one, and he said, Afghanistan.
Don't forget also that there had been 9/11, and the Afghan invasion of Afghanistan was revenge for 9/11, and it would have been quite difficult for him as a politician to come out against that. But the trouble is, I don't think it was just expediency. I think he actually believed it and still believes that this was a necessary war.
There are myths aplenty as well surrounding Sharia law, Sadaqat, both in its history and also in current Western perceptions. But your whole book could be read as a rejection of one of the most persistent, that Sharia is some kind of monolithic entity.
Sure. I mean, I've written the book specifically to tackle that era. I mean, if you look at the 1400 years of Islamic history, there have been dozens of interpretations. There's no such thing as a single interpretation of the Sharia. What has happened, though, and this is what I try to show in the second half of my book, which is more of a travelogue than a history, is that in the last 30, 40 years, there has been a revival of these very pernicious, very extreme versions of Islam, which do stress punishment and which ignore the other traditions, which obviously are also part of Islam, like mercy and tolerance. And tying into what Jonathan was just saying, one of the things that poured most fuel onto that fire, which stoked the extremism, was the Afghanistan war. If we went back 40 years, there would only have been one country in the world which purported to apply the Sharia, and that was Saudi Arabia. Then an army officer took power in North Africa and decided that he was going to exploit religious law for political purposes. His name was Colonel Gaddafi, not the most religious of men, but he became the first person outside Saudi Arabia to claim that he was enforcing the Sharia. Then you had another military general in Pakistan, General Zia-ul-Haq, And then you had the Iranian Revolution and, of course, the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets in 1979. And so what I do try to show in the book is that the face that the Western world sees of the Sharia today very often isn't something eternal and unchanging. It's something that's been created by coups and wars and revolutions and occupations over the last 30, 40 years. And it's very important to understand that as a first stage to tackling the problems, because there are huge problems, and many of those problems need to be tackled within the Muslim world themselves. Most of those problems need to be tackled within the Muslim world themselves. And as I say in my book, I deal with the way that the Sharia is applied in Pakistan and in Iran and in several other countries in the Middle East.
You trace the roots of these more aggressive interpretations back to a scholar in the 14th century called Ahmad ibn Taymiyyah. But it is the political situation at the end of the 20th century with the war in Afghanistan as one of the driving factors that has driven this gradual increase in aggression of interpretations.
Sure. I mean, there are interpretations of Islamic law which can be put to the service of the hardliners and the militants today. And as you've mentioned, Ahmad ibn Taymiyyah, he's preeminent in that field. I mean, he was writing at a time when the Mongols had swept through the Muslim world, absolutely devastated it, killed hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people. And he basically said, in a situation like this, it's entirely proper to fight back. Jihad isn't simply a spiritual struggle. It isn't simply part of the struggle to convert people, which is the way that it had been understood before, but it can actually just be a war, a simple war of self-defense, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, no one's really going to argue against wars of self-defense. But his ideas have been put to very unfortunate purposes. That isn't a purely 20th century construct. I mean, the first person who did that was Al-Wahhab in the 18th century, the ideological progenitor of the Saudi Revolution. But his teachings have been revived, particularly in the 1970s. They were revived, first of all, to deadly effect, to justify the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Then they were revived in the context of resistance to Israel in terms of, first of all, military warfare, and then, of course, in terms of suicide bombing as well. And nowadays, they're used all over the world. I mean, in Afghanistan, they were used by Abdullah Azam, who cited Ibn Taymiyyah as a reason why all Muslims should spring to the defence of Afghanistan. And during the 1980s, this brought Mujahideen, people waging jihad from all over the Muslim world, into Afghanistan.
And of course now it's happening in Syria, because the Wahhabis are coming into Syria and it's turning into an anti-Shia thing, which makes it even more pernicious. It's creating this terrible split within the Muslim community, isn't
it? And Syria is a very interesting example, because Syria is actually where Ibn Taymiyyah came from in the 14th century. He lived in Damascus, and in Damascus there were allegations even then that the Shia collaborated with the Mongols, and these allegations have been revived 6 centuries later. You get Sunni propaganda against the Shia saying that they're the descendants of the people who collaborated with the Mongols in the 14th century. They haven't changed, and exactly as it was necessary to stamp them out of the 14th century, it's necessary to stamp them out now. So there is this horrible sectarian divide which is opening up in Syria now.
There's this terrible thing whereby each new development sparks another new development, which then sparks a worse new development, which then there's a steady increase in the violence of the whole thing. For example, the very harshness of Sharia law was an argument used by supporters of the US-led invasion in 2001, Jonathan.
To try and stamp it out?
Because
the Taliban are the most extreme form of Sharia law, merchants and all the rest of it. That is true. And then, of course, they added in the issue of women's rights and so on to try and win over Western liberal opinion to support the invasion. Yes, it's absolutely true.
But instead of a withdrawal now, which continues the conflict with US troops still left in Afghanistan and Afghan forces fighting the insurgency instead of the US-led force which is in there now, you suggest instead that there should be a negotiated settlement involving all of the parties and indeed regional partners as well. But what do you say to those who bring up the case of women's rights and say that that would be a disaster for women in Afghanistan?
Well, you can't invade countries to liberate women, especially if you come from a totally different culture with a different religion and different background and so on. So that's the first thing. Secondly, unfortunately, women's rights have been trampled on for centuries in Afghanistan, and they're not going to change quickly. And it's not just the Taliban who are oppressors of women. They are very bad, but you get it in the Tajik areas, in the Uzbek areas, and you get it even in Kabul in the city areas too.
Well, and you get it in Pakistan. You know, Pakistan is at least theoretically, nominally, an ally in the war on terror. You know, no one's talking about invading Pakistan as yet, and rightfully so. You get it in India. You get female infanticide in India. You know, that's not associated with Islam. That's associated with Hinduism. There is an unfortunate degree of misogyny in South Asia. There's no denying that. But first of all, I'd say that that isn't necessarily associated with the Sharia. It's certainly associated with parts of the Sharia, but the Sharia is far, far wider. It's understood by Muslims as a path towards salvation, not a list of rules. And secondly, it can't serve as a justification for invasion or for military force.
The wave of revolutions which followed the Arab Spring have been just as varied as Sharia law itself, as Sarakat was explaining. You've just returned from Damascus, Jonathan. What do you make of those who fear that the Syrian rebellion might bring Sharia law to Syria?
Well, there's some element of truth in that, because the dominant force in this rebellion against the Assad government is the Muslim Brotherhood, who would favour Sharia law, and now increasingly these more jihadi type Islamists and the Wahhabis who are coming from Saudi Arabia, etc. So there is that danger, which is why many people, particularly in Damascus, and I think in Aleppo too, although I didn't visit Aleppo, are worried about the alternative to the Assad government. They're not at all in favour of the government as such. They want it to reform and change, modernise, liberalise and all the rest of it, but they do not want it to be replaced by something worse, and so that's why many people are sitting on the fence, really, and quite concerned. And the second point, which is of course the destruction. You know, this is not an intellectual debate about what kind of government we want. This is a country which is now being forced by outside powers, largely, who are arming people, to turn into civil war. And so you get in Damascus, tens of thousands of people have been displaced in the last few weeks, living now in shelters of one kind or another, many of them in schools. They see the war creeping inexorably towards them, and so they desperately want an end to it. A ceasefire is the crucial thing, which I think everybody outside the country should also be pushing for.
I would just add one caveat to that. I agree generally with everything that Jonathan said, but again, Sharia can become a bit of a red herring. I mean, there are plenty of states in the Muslim world which claim that they abide by the Sharia, and that doesn't mean amputations, it doesn't mean stonings to death, it doesn't mean discrimination against women. It can mean all those things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. As far as a Muslim is concerned, the Sharia, it means literally the path towards salvation. But any Muslim country which said we are going to ignore the Sharia would have no legitimacy whatsoever in the eyes of the majority of the population.
You make a distinction between Sharia and fiqh.
In my book I talk about these two words, the Sharia, which is the spiritual concept of the path towards water it originally meant in the 7th century, metaphorically the path towards salvation. It's got a precise Jewish equivalent, the halakha. The English equivalent, I'd say, would be the straight and narrow. So that's one concept, the Sharia. Then there's another word in Arabic, which is fiqh, which means understanding. And that's the human interpretations of the Sharia. No Muslim has ever denied that human interpretations of the Sharia can be wrong. Any Muslim worth their salt is going to think that certain interpretations of the Sharia are wrong. But it's those interpretations which should be tackled, and those violent extremism that should be tackled. If you set yourself against the Sharia, you're basically setting yourself against devout Muslims around the world, and that doesn't do anyone any favours.
You speak in Ghosts of Afghanistan about the situation of the third Mujahid in Afghanistan, who barely knows who the opponents are or why his local leaders are fighting. Is the opposition in Syria similarly diverse, or is it clear who the enemy is, at least?
Oh, no, it is very diverse. I mean, there are these things actually called local coordination committees. They are just groups of young men in various small towns, villages and so on, who've sort of taken up arms. Now they're getting more help from outside, but they have no real coordination, no military coordination. Nobody's giving them command and control. You know, they're very much a law unto themselves. In some areas they are much more Islamist than in others. Some areas they're really quite secular. I think in the suburbs around Damascus, it is unemployed youth living in rotten housing estates, you know, rather like you get in the London riots or in the Paris bidonville. You know, it's the same kind of thing. And then some people have come in and put a sort of Islamic slant on it, and it has a certain mobilizing effect. But I think basically this is a political, economic revolt, not a sort of religious one.
It's all a question of differing interpretations yet again. The role of the web in the Arab Spring has perhaps been a little overstated, but will the internet play a part in shaping the future evolution of Sharia, Sarakat?
I'd be amazed if it didn't play a part in the evolution of Islamic law. As I say, the Sharia is a spiritual concept. concept rather than an actual concept. But in terms of interpretations of Islamic law, I'm sure it's going to play a role. I mean, you get chat rooms where people are arguing about understandings of Islamic law. You get khutbas, you get sermons, which can be played anywhere around the world nowadays. According to Orthodox scholars, one source of Islamic law has always been consensus in the Sunni community. Although it's very difficult to know what the consensus is, there's always been arguments about how you ascertain that consensus, obviously, and it's pretty difficult when you have a world population of Muslims of 1.6 billion people. But the fact that voices are being heard and different views are being aired via the internet is bound to change Islamic law. Whether that's for good or for ill, only the future can tell.
Sadaqat Kadri and Jonathan Steele. 20 years after the Falklands War, the mythical importance of the Malvinas is still great in Buenos Aires. Carlos Gamero, who published his novel The Islands in 1998 and reworked it for the stage only last year, tells us how he came to be writing a detective story about a war which should have had his name on it.
The Islands, it is related to the Malvinas-Falklands War of 1982. But it takes place 10 years later. It's more about the aftermath of the war and also the context of the dictatorship and the return to democracy in Argentina. But at the same time, well, it's been called a cyber thriller because the protagonist is a hacker who's asked to investigate a crime. Actually, he's got to cover up for the criminal rather than find the culprit. But in his investigation, somehow he always has to go back, or the investigation takes him back to the time of the war, 10 years back.
So how did you find yourself writing a novel about the Malvinas?
Well, originally I was thinking of a crime thriller. The Malvinas wasn't there from the very beginning. I don't really know how it got in. I suppose, well, there are personal reasons. I am the class of 62. I am the class that was sent to Malvinas. I didn't go to the war. But maybe I always felt that I had somehow avoided destiny. And well, I usually speak of literature that is, I like to speak of literature that is autobiographical, but in sort of in reverse. I mean, the story of what didn't happen to you, but might have happened or maybe should have happened. It's maybe a way of exorcising the story which of, you know, what would my life would have been if I had, you know, been sent to the war. Well, if I had survived.
Because your protagonist, Felipe Félix, he'd served in the war himself in opposition to you. But he tries to avoid it, he tries to not think about it, he tries to push it away, but it's always there. He sees it in a stain on the wall, he sees it, and it crops up everywhere for him. Was it similar for you writing the novel? Were the Malvinas unavoidable in the end?
On the one hand, they are unavoidable in Argentine history. I mean, there is a whole narrative of Argentina that has a lot to do with military heroism that came to a catastrophic end with the war, and it wasn't just a return to democracy, but a sort of trying to recreate the nation on a new basis after the war. And in that sense, the Malvinas are everywhere, in a sense which, of course, the Falklands are not for the UK. On the other hand, when I was working on the novel, I interviewed the veterans from the war, and in their case, it was, of course, clear that their lives were completely shaped or warped by those that month and a half they spent there. Even now, 30 years later, their talk is, you know, very much about the islands. And especially something that always amazed me is many of the ones I interviewed were highly critical of the war and the military. They actually collaborated with the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo. But still, when I asked them, but would you go back to the islands if you had a chance, they all said yes. Now, this need to return to the islands, not necessarily to return to fight or to get a sort of return match, actually, is the word we use in the novel. Maybe something was given to them there or something very precious was lost there. They obsessively go back to the islands in their thoughts, in their memory, in their dreams.
The islands, for these soldiers in the novel, is not only almost a figure of love, but also a nightmare. There's a very powerful passage where one of them speaks about how it's the nightmare situation for a private soldier, in that it's a war you can't even hope to run away from. Was this something that the soldiers you talked to felt?
Yes, both in the soldiers I talked with and also in many books of testimonies and memoirs, Usually one of the strongest fantasies for a soldier is the fantasy of deserting. But I suppose for most of us who've been married also, the fantasy of divorce or separation, it helps us get by on a day-by-day basis. It's like, you're not going to do it, but just to think that you might be able to do it or that you can do it helps you to get to the end of the day. They didn't have this. I mean, they were in islands, and not everybody might remember, but I mean, after the sinking of the Belgrano, which everybody does remember, what it meant in practical terms is that the soldiers stationed in the islands were isolated. There were no ships going between the islands and the continent, and practically no planes. So it was like, okay, either we win or we are taken back as prisoners, and there is no way we can run away from this.
The novel is set in 1992, 10 years later, and you were writing it in the years that followed 1992 and published in 1998, but you came back to it last year as a stage show now. What's it like coming back to it 20 years after the invasion? Has the feeling changed?
In the same way that the war and the Malvinas as an issue have not died, they have just mutated and transformed over the last 30 years. I think Las Islas, the Islands, it's a novel that I always felt, well, I called it an omnivorous novel, which it could sort of chew up and digest anything, and I wanted it to be that way. It's always been a very protean novel. It doesn't have a really fixed form. I mean, it wasn't easy turning it into a play, but it has a great potential for transformation. And even when we started work with Ian Barnett, my translator, on the English version, the first thing I did was to sort of change the original. Actually, it's about 100 pages shorter. In a 600-page novel, it doesn't make much of a difference, but still, I can still see it changing over time. This is not true of all of my novels. I mean, my other novel published in English, An Open Secret, I feel it's got a very tight novel, very carefully constructed, and it's got a fixed form. And if anybody would tell me to change it, I would say, no, I mean, there's nothing to change. In the Islands, I can see another version, you know, in a different format in 10 years' time, and I have great fun with it. Even when I try to leave it, it comes back to me.
Your hacker, Felipe, when he comes up with the list of suspects that he's supposed to turn up with for the businessman who's trying to suppress this murder, he finds the list has been hacked against him. You send him out onto the streets like an old-fashioned gumshoe. Was the idea of sending him out there was so that you could, as you say, chew up everything? Was it to get the whole of Argentine society?
I think it was Frederick Jameson, the critic, who in one of his pieces on the American noir novel, and specifically on Raymond Chandler, said that in our contemporary, I mean modern times really, in our fragmented societies, practically the only figure that could cover all the different sort of territories a society, especially in big cities, is broken into, is the detective. Otherwise we have sort of very fragmentary, almost domestic accounts of life in one social stratum, which usually means also in one part of the city. And yes, I always had a fascination with this, you know, the figure of the detective in the noir, especially in the noir thriller. But of course, there were two problems for me. One is that we do not have private eyes in Argentina. Actually, we do have them, but they're all either ex-cops or ex-secret service, which doesn't make them very reliable or very honest. I mean, and not definitely not very likable characters. And well, I wanted my hero was also, my protagonist was also in a way a hero, a point of view. He was a first-person narrator. I wanted to feel some sympathy with the guy. That's maybe my limitation. Later in An Open Secret, I tried to tell the story first from the point of view of a provincial cop, and I failed. I mean, I just have this gut thing against these guys, maybe because I lived through the dictatorship. But at one point I thought, oh, okay, can't be a detective, and what would be a sort of contemporary equivalent? Well, a hacker does the same thing in computers, and what if my hacker, after agreeing to do it in the cyber world and failing, is sort of convinced by Mr. Tamerlan, his employer, okay, I mean, you failed with the computers, you'd better go out there on the streets and do it. He knows how to do, but he has to improvise. And in a way, he says he treats the city as a sort of Google map. Well, he doesn't use a Google map as an expression. It didn't exist at the time, I think. He pretends it's just another computer thing. Of course, he has to engage with real people, and things start changing for him very, very, very quickly.
Did you have a model for your gumshoe? I mean, was it Raymond Chandler, or in the city under the reign of Ian Rankin? Was it a more northern kind of gumshoe you had in mind?
Yeah, at the time I was mostly reading the older sort of U.S. tradition, so it was the Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, and a few others. I'd say. But and maybe also sort of other examples as the Blade Runner in Blade Runner has got this sort of Chandler feel to him, but is acting in a definitely more sort of sci-fi setting. My novel has been labeled as sci-fi. I don't think it is exactly genre. I mean, it belongs to a genre, but it takes elements from that genre. Also, at one point, when I started writing the novel, I mean, the novel takes place in 92, as you said, and it was 1992 when I began, and I wanted to write a novel about the present. But at the same time, I realized that if you write about the present, by the time the novel gets published, it is the distant past. So I anticipated some things that I knew would happen in Buenos Aires but hadn't happened yet, like the internet. I give us the internet in 92 when we didn't have it, and I developed Puerto Madero, which is an area very much like Canary Wharf, which at the time was barren. And I made Tamerlan, I mean, who is a real estate tycoon, into the first sort of the builder of Puerto Madero. So I had fun with that. And yes, the novel was seen as something very sort of updated because I had kind of predated what the immediate future would be like.
Your villain, the Señor Tamerlan, is an extraordinary figure who first appears at the top of his new Canary Wharf-style tower, made of mirrors, yeah, and appears to bugger his own son. Where did he come from?
If I said from within myself, I'd be giving readers the wrong impression. I tried to create an evil character who could sort of summarize many of the horrors of recent Argentine history, which was quite a challenge. He's not in the military, but he's involved with them. I mean, he benefited from the coup, definitely. He's also the son of a Nazi who was the director of a concentration camp. It's kind of funny in the novel. I don't know if it's funny. It's kind of awful. He always says, "I was brought up in the campo." In Spanish, we have the same word for the country, the countryside, and the camp. And only at the end of the novel, you realize he means a concentration camp and not the countryside. And of course, he belongs to this very rapacious business bourgeoisie who didn't actually do the killings during the dictatorship, but they were the ones who promoted them and who often handed the lists to the military of, oh, these are the workers from our firm that we need to get rid of. But at the same time, he is obsessed with conceiving his own son. He is a misogynist, but a sort of utopian misogynist. He's also gay, which doesn't neatly fit into, like, you know, a model sort of fascist villain. He's more complicated than that. And increasingly you feel that he himself is becoming also a kind of outcast. He is too radical for the system to accept him.
It's a novel full of cartoonish violence, full of extremes, of caricatures. Are these an attempt to reflect this hyper-reality, an attempt to reflect the horrors or respond to the horrors, the all too real, the unbelievable but all too real horrors of life under the junta?
Yes, I mean, I feel when reality is so unreal, I mean, realism as a genre cannot hope to capture it. I mean, the Malvinas War itself was a completely, I mean, absurd and surreal, an incredible war, also because it was fed to us during the 2 months and a half it lasted as a complete fiction. I mean, we were being told of how the small Argentine-made Pucará, you know, a little plane, would sort of sink the Hermes aircraft carrier. And, you know, they were writing those things and making them into really elaborate narratives, and everybody was buying them. So how do you then tone that down to a sort of realistic account of what the war was like? So in my case, instead of talking about the war first, I do eventually in the novel, I narrate the experience of those who were, let's say, in the trenches, or rather in the foxholes. But I began with a video game in which Argentina is able to defeat Great Britain, no, which was already part of the unreality of the war. Also, I go to history, I do a lot of research, but usually to find the incredible fact. Now, there's been a video game of the Malvinas War created about 10 years after my novel. So, you know, I always say fiction creates reality rather than reflect it.
Carlos Gamero bringing down the curtain on our coverage of the Edinburgh International Book Festival right back where we started, with a paean to the power of fiction. So, after 2 weeks here in Charlotte Square, it's time to say goodbye from me, Richard Lee, our producer, Ian Chambers, and from all the Guardian Books team. See you next week.
This idea of writing to a rhythm, the idea of discarding this clattering machinery of narrative plot.
Saturday's child is still growing into her eyes, lamps above her chin, a frog's eyes surfacing the muds of winter. She can't help what she does and doesn't see, salting away what she sees inside her.
I, who have written many books, cannot repair a dripping tap or sew a button on a shirt. Why am I such a useless chap? Count Tolstoy emptied chamber pots. Why do I flinch from household chores?
Uncle Deuce tones rising up high, like bubbles fae fermented giggles fly. Guy Goofy, bounding on like a trooper, charm us sleek at rabble, jammy number.
I stay under the cover of ferns where the nightjar nests, eat stolen eggs while they dip their bread in pickles and warm gin, unfurl silk handkerchiefs and bask like adders on crushed bedding.
Sunbathing on the lawn, you watch the way the ants crawling up your empty water glass collect, almost circular, around the white fogged patch of your fingerprint. You remember earlier taking a white peach from the bowl, thinking slicing would be tidier in front of him. Mostly out of laziness, the sun, the new ease between you and him. You bit into it whole. Juice ran from your lips and chin to stain your dress, pieces of flesh staying behind in your teeth. You wonder if the ants are eating tiny molecules of peach, or what else from your day could have been left behind. The tiniest flakes of you, maybe.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.